This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please contact LibriVox.org. Recorded by Peter Yearsley. Ghost Stories of an Antiquary. I believe I had the pleasure of telling you the story of an adventure which happened to a friend of mine by the name of Denniston during his pursuit of objects of art for the museum at Cambridge. He did not publish his experiences very widely upon his return to England, but they could not fail to become known to a good many of his friends, and among others, to the gentleman who at that time presided over an art museum at another university. It was to be expected that the story should make a considerable impression on the mind of a man whose vocation lay in lines similar to Denniston's, and that he should be eager to catch at any explanation of the matter which tended to make it seem improbable that he should ever be called upon to deal with so agitating an emergency. It was indeed somewhat consoling to him to reflect that he was not expected to acquire ancient manuscripts for his institution. That was the business of the Shelburnian Library. The authorities of that institution might, if they pleased, ransack obscure corners of the continent for such matters. He was glad to be obliged at the moment to confine his attention to enlarging the already unsurpassed collection of English topographical drawings and engravings possessed by his museum. Yet, as it turned out, even a department so homely and familiar as this may have its dark corners, and to one of these Mr. Williams was unexpectedly introduced. Those who have taken even the most limited interest in the acquisition of topographical pictures are aware that there is one London dealer whose aid is indispensable to their researches. Mr. J. W. Britnell publishes at short intervals very admirable catalogues of a large and constantly changing stock of engravings, plans, and old sketches of mansions, churches, and towns in England and Wales. These catalogues were, of course, the ABC of his subject to Mr. Williams, but as his museum already contained an enormous accumulation of topographical pictures, he was a regular rather than a copious buyer, and he rather looked to Mr. Britnell to fill up gaps in the rank and file of his collection and to supply him with rarities. Now, in February of last year, there appeared upon Mr. Williams's desk at the museum a catalogue
Of 2 guineas to such an object.
was more than Mr. Williams could imagine. He turned it over with a good deal of contempt. Upon the back was a paper label, the left hand half of which had been torn off. All that remained were the ends of two lines of writing. The first had the letters Me Hall, NGLEYHALL. The second, SSEX. It would perhaps be just worthwhile to identify the place represented, which he could easily do with the help of the gazetteer, and then he would send it back to Mr. Bricknell with some remarks reflecting upon the judgment of that gentleman. He lighted the candles, for it was now dark, made the tea, and supplied the friend with whom he had been playing golf, for I believe the authorities at the university I write of indulge in that pursuit by way of relaxation, and tea was taken to the accompaniment of a discussion which golfing persons can imagine for themselves, but which the conscientious writer has no right to inflict upon any non-golfing persons. The conclusion arrived at was that certain strokes might have been better, and that in certain emergencies neither player had experienced that amount of luck which a human being has a right to expect. It was now that the friend, let us call him Professor Binks, took up the framed engraving and said, "What's this place, Williams?" "Just what I was going to try to find out," said Williams, going to the shelf for a gazetteer. "Look at the back. Something we hold, either in Sussex or Essex. Half the name's gone, you see. You don't happen to know it, I suppose." "It's from that man Bricknell, I suppose, isn't it?" said Binks. "Is it from the museum? Well, I think I should buy it if the price was 5 shillings, said Williams. "But for some unearthly reason, he wants 2 guineas for it. I can't conceive why. It's a wretched engraving, and there aren't even any figures to give it life. It's not worth 2 guineas, I should think," said Binks. "But I don't think it's so badly done. The moonlight seemed rather good to me, and I should have thought that there were figures, or at least a figure, just on the edge in front." "Let's look," said Williams. "Oh, it's true the light is rather cleverly given. Where's your figure? Oh, yes, just the head in the very front of the picture." And indeed there was, hardly more than a black blot on the extreme edge of the engraving. The head of a man or woman, a good deal muffled up, the back turned to the spectator, and looking towards the house. Williams had not noticed it before. "Still," he said, "though it's a cleverer thing than I thought, I can't spend 2 guineas of museum money on a picture of a place I don't know." Professor Binks had his work to do, and soon went, and very nearly up to hall time, Williams was engaged in desk. There, he locked it up in a drawer, bolted the doors of both rooms, and retired to bed. But first he wrote out and signed an account of the extraordinary train which the Pickler had undergone since it had come into his possession. Sleep visited him rather late, but it was consoling to reflect that the behavior of the picture did not depend on his own unsupported testimony. Evidently, the man who had looked at it the night before had seen something of the same kind as he had. Otherwise, he might have been tempted to think that something gravely wrong was happening, either to his eyes or his mind. This possibility being fortunately precluded, two matters awaited him on the morrow. He must take stock of the picture very carefully and call in a witness for the purpose, and he must make a determined effort to ascertain what house it was that was represented. He would therefore ask his neighbor Nisbet to breakfast with him, and he would subsequently spend the morning over the gazetteer. Nisbet was disengaged and arrived about 9:20. His host was not quite dressed, I'm sorry to say, even at this late hour. During breakfast, nothing was said about the matter tint by Williams, save that he had a picture on which he wished for Nisbet's opinion. But those who are familiar with university life can picture for themselves the wide and delightful range of subjects over which the conversation of two fellows of Canterbury College is likely to extend during a Sunday morning breakfast. Hardly a topic was left unchallenged, from golf to lawn tennis. Yet I am bound to say that Williams was rather distraught, for his interest naturally centered in that very strange picture which was now reposing face downwards in the drawer in the room opposite. The morning pipe was at last lighted, and the moment had arrived for which he looked. With very considerable, almost tremulous excitement, he ran across, unlocked the drawer, and extracting the picture still face downwards, ran back and put it into Nisbet's hands. "Now," he said, "Nisbet, I want you to tell me exactly what you see in that picture. Describe it, if you don't mind, rather minutely. I'll tell you why afterwards." "Well," said Nisbet, "I have here a view of a country house, English, I presume, by moonlight."
"Moonlight? You're sure of that?"
"Certainly. The moon appears to be on the wane, if you wish for details, and there are clouds in the sky."
"All right. Go on. I'll swear,"
added Williams in an aside, "there was no moon when I saw it first."
"Well, there's not much more to be said," Nisbet continued.
"The house has one, two, three rows
is just one other thing.
What?
Why, one of the windows on the ground floor, left of the door, is open.
Is it really so?
My goodness, he must have got in, said Williams with great excitement, and he hurried to the back of the sofa on which Nesbit was sitting, and catching the picture from him, verified the matter for himself. It was quite true. There was no figure, and there was the open window. Williams, after a moment of speechless surprise, went to the writing table and scribbled for a short time. Then he brought two papers to Nesbit and asked him first to sign one. It was his own description of the picture, which you have just heard, and then to read the other, which was William's statement written the night before.
What can it all mean?
Said Nesbit.
Exactly,
said Williams. Well, one thing I must do, or three things now I think of it, I must find out from Garwood, this was his last night's visitor, what he saw. And then I must get the thing photographed before it goes further. And then I must find out what the place is.
I can do the photographing myself, said Nesbit, and I will. But you know, it looks very much as if we were assisting at the working out of a tragedy somewhere.
The question is, has it happened already, or is it going to come off? You must find out what the place is.
Yes, he said, looking at the picture again.
I expect you're right. He has got it. And if I don't mistake, there'll be the devil to pay in one of the rooms upstairs.
I'll tell you what, said Williams. I'll take the picture across to Old Green.
This was the senior fellow of the college who had been bursar for many years.
It's quite likely you'll know it. We have property in Essex and Sussex, and he must have been over the two counties a lot in his time.
Quite likely he will, said Nesbit, but just let me take my photograph first.
But look here, I rather think Green isn't up today.
He wasn't in all last night, and I think I heard him say he was going down for the Sunday.
That's true, too, said Williams. I know he's gone to Brighton.
Well, if you'll photograph it now, I'll go across to Garwood and get his statement.
And you keep an eye on it while I'm gone. I'm beginning to think 2 guineas is not a very exorbitant price for it now.
In a short time, he had returned and brought Mr. Garwood with him. Garwood's statement was to the effect that the figure, when he had seen it, was clear of the edge of the picture, but had not got far across the lawn. He remembered a white mark on the back of its drapery, but could not picture it was a cross. A document to this effect was then drawn up and signed, and Nesbit proceeded to photograph the picture.
Now what do you want to do?
He said. Are you going to sit and watch it all day?
Well, no, I think not, said Williams. I rather imagine we're meant to see the whole thing.
You see, the window being open, I think, must mean that it's in there now. So I feel quite easy about leaving it. And besides, I have a kind of idea that it wouldn't change much, if at all, in the daytime. You might go out for a walk this afternoon and come in to tea or whenever it gets dark. I shall leave it out on the table here and sport the door. My skip can get in, but no one else. The three agreed that this would be a good plan, and further, that if they spent the afternoon together, they would be less likely to talk about the business to other people, for any rumour of such a transaction as was going on would bring the whole of the Phasmatological Society about their ears. We may give them a respite until 5 o'clock. At or near that hour, the three were entering Williams's staircase. They were at first slightly annoyed to see that the door of his rooms was unsported, but in a moment it was remembered that on Sunday the skips came to orders an hour or so earlier than on weekdays. However, a surprise was awaiting them. The first thing they saw was a picture leaning up against a pile of books on the table as if they'd been left. And the next thing was Williams and Skip seated on a chair opposite, gazing at it with undisguised horror. How was this? Mr. Filcher, the name is not my own invention, was a servant of considerable standing, and set the standards of etiquette to all his own college and to several neighbouring ones, and nothing could be more alien to his practice than to be found sitting on his master's chair, or appearing to take any particular notice of his master's furniture or pictures. Indeed, he seemed to feel this himself. He started violently when the three men were in the room, and got up with a marked effort. Then he said, "I ask your pardon, sir, for taking such a freedom as to sit down." "Not at all, Robert," interposed Mr. Williams. "I was meaning to ask you sometime what you thought of that picture. Also, of course, I don't set up my opinion against yours, but it ain't the picture I should hang where my little girl could see it, sir."
"Wouldn't you, Robert?"
"Why not?" "No, sir. Why, the poor child will recollect when she sees it. Dull Bible with pictures not half what that is, and we had to set up with her 3 or 4 nights afterwards, if you'll believe me. And if you was to catch a sight of this skeleton here, or if it is carrying off the poor baby, she would be the taking. You know how it is with children. And nobody said yet, the little thing and all. But what I should say, it don't seem the right picture to be laying about, sir. Not where anyone's love would be startled and come on it. Should you be wanting anything this evening, sir?"
"Thank you, sir."
With these words, the excellent man went to continue the round of his masters, and you may be sure the gentleman whom he left lost no time in gathering round the engraving. There was I
Always very
whenever he got a chance, he used to get a man whom he suspected of it turned off the estate, and by degrees he got rid of them all but one. Squires couldn't do a lot of things then that they daren't think of now. Well, this man that was left was what you find pretty often in that country, the last remains of a very old family. I believe they were lords of the manor at one time. I recollect just the same thing in my own parish. What, like the man in Tessa the D'Urbervilles? Williams put in. Yes, I dare say. It's not a book I could ever read myself, but this fellow could show a row of tombs in the church there that belonged to his ancestors, and all that went to sour him a bit. But Sir Francis, they said, could never get at him. He always kept just on the right side of the law. Until one night, the keepers found him at it in a wood right at the end of the estate. I can show you the place now. It marches with some land that used to belong to an uncle of mine. And you can imagine all the row. And this man Gordy, that's the name, to be sure, Gordy. I thought I should get it, Gordy. He was unlucky enough, poor chap, to shoot a keeper. Well, that was what Francis wanted. And grand juries, you know what they would have been then. And poor Gordy was strung up in double quick time. And I've been shown the place he was buried in, on the north side of the church. You know the way in that part of the world. Anyone that's been hanged or made away with themselves, they bury them that side. And the idea was that some friend of Gordy's, not a relation, because he had none, poor devil. He was the last of his line. Kind of spes ultima gentis. Must have planned to get hold of Francis's boy and put an end to his line, too. I don't know. It's rather an out-of-the-way thing for an Essex poacher to think of. But, you know, I should say now it looks more as if old Gordy had managed the job himself. Ugh, I hate to think of it. Have some whiskey, Williams. The facts were communicated by Williams to Deniston, and by him to a mixed company of which I was one. And the said Lucian Professor of Ophiology another. I am sorry to say that the latter, when asked what he thought of it, only remarked, "Oh, those Bridgeford people will say anything," a sentiment which met with the reception it deserved. I have only to add that the picture is now in the Ashley Museum, that it has been treated with a view to discover whether sympathetic ink has been used in it, but without effect, that Mr. Britmore knew nothing of it, save that he was sure it was uncommon, and that, though carefully watched, it has never been known.